Hey there, back together again, Thursday style, November 20th, 2025, on Connecticut Today. I wondered out loud if Connecticut should follow in the footsteps of some other cities and institute or experiment once again with free municipal bus rides. Republican State Rep. Craig Fischbein talked to us about a new state audit on a massive backlog of state gun permit appeals cases. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso stopped by with his weekly update looking at all things Bridgeport and Connecticut, while CBS News military analyst retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland dropped by to offer his thoughts on U.S. military strikes being used against suspected drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean. All right, so admittedly, I'm probably going to get smacked around a little on this, but this is a fascinating issue here. And we did it once here in the great state of Connecticut, and I'm wondering, should we do it again? Now, what it is, or was, or would be, or if we ever brought it back, free bus rides. Remember that during the pandemic, in an effort to get people out of their cars, but to keep the economy moving, the CT transit buses were free. And I guess that ran till late 2023 or early 2024 when the money, the COVID-19, the stimulus money from COVID-19 ran out. And so, you know, transit buses are charging fares again. And, you know, I was poking around today looking for, you know, something a little, I mean, we've done the Epstein files. We're talking about the 37th arrest. No, I'm sorry, the fourth arrest of Alfredo Castillo. And I was wondering if we could get a little deeper into maybe doing something a little differently here. But by doing something differently, going back to what a lot of people actually didn't know what was going on a few years ago when we did it, and it was kind of successful, according to at least some of the stuff that I've read. And CT transit buses were free versus people paying the normal fare. Well, that ran out several months ago, and now people are paying the fare again. Because, again, when the bus rides are free, they're not free all around. Somebody has got to pay for the bus use, the drivers, the CT personnel, CT transit personnel, the fuel, the diesel, or the electric power to charge the buses, if they're electric buses or hybrid buses, maintenance people there. So on the final user, kind of like the end user agreement that everybody clicks yes on when we install software on anything, the EULA, the End User License Agreement. Well, the end user of a municipal bus is the person now that is paying to ride that bus. And one of the issues that emerged a few miles down the road from us during the just concluded, rather tense and newsworthy New York City mayor's race was the gentleman who eventually won it, Zohran Mamdani, saying, hey, I think all New York City buses should be free. Now, other places have done that. They've experimented with it. Memphis is doing it now. It's being done now, I think, as an experiment in Iowa City, Iowa. Kansas City, I think, did it for a short time, or they may still be doing it. So I'm wondering, how about free bus fares here in Connecticut? Wouldn't that be a good thing? I guess the first time we did it, there were fewer cars on the road. There was less pollution out there, would stand to reason. I mean, hey, you want a green initiative? Why not take some of this money that we're putting toward every sort of green initiative and redirect it toward the bus lines, the bus companies? Now, I know what you're saying. How do you pay for it, Paul? Well, according to this story I'm looking at here in the New York Times, Iowa City, Iowa made its buses free. There was less traffic. The air was better. Ridership jumped. People cut back on driving. And over the summer, it was so successful that they're going to extend it for another year. Now, where does the money come from? Well, yeah, they ended up raising certain fees. I'll tell you what they did momentarily. But let's start off with this today, because I, you know what? I'd be willing to do this. And should state money pay for it? Yeah. And I think the first time we did it, during the pandemic, I think the tab was something like $70 million a year, meaning that's what CT Transit was getting from the state for their labor, their maintenance, the use of the bus, paying the drivers, paying the mechanics, and all that. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Should the state, and I've got some rather interesting comments on there already, should the state look into making CT Transit buses free to ride? Now, you may say, well, wait a minute, Paul, that's going to cost money. But we're spending money on these so-called green initiatives as it is, with mixed results. Some people say, oh, the solar panels, the solar panel farms, the offshore wind, that's too expensive. Well, do you think paying for free buses is a waste of money or a good idea here? I'd like to see us go back to it for a year or two and take a look. Now, obviously, there are safety concerns here. You don't want drivers, the men and women who drive these buses, you don't want them having to drive around, let's face it, you know, mentally ill people all day, turning the buses into a, you know, rolling homeless shelters. That's something I guess there'd be some concern about. But is this the wave of the future? We did it once here in Connecticut. Incoming Mayor Zohran Mamdani wants to do it in New York. They're doing it in Iowa. They're doing it in Memphis. And they did it for a time in Kansas City, and I guess they're reevaluating it again. Where could they get the money? So you tell me, what do you think? Free municipal bus rides. I know it's not free in a sense, but shall we say no fare bus rides, F-A-I-F-A-R-E, not F-A-I-R. You tell me. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Should the state look into making CT Transit buses free to ride? Yeah, you know what's on my mind? Wanted to start on something a little lighter today before we get into all the slop and the muck and the absentee ballot stuff and gun permits today. Coming up, we'll have that. The Epstein files, surprise, they may be highly redacted. We told you about that. But an interesting story, and credit to our friend Tom Dudchick on the Connecticut CT Capital Report.com. Another major metro area is extending its free commuter bus service. And there's a really interesting story that Tom posted there from Iowa City, Iowa. They made their buses free, and when that happened, traffic got was lessened. The air quality was better. Ridership jumped. People cut back on driving. And I'm looking at this saying, well, wait a minute. We spend so much money on other, quote unquote, you know, green initiatives. Some people like them. Some people hate them. Some people are in the middle like, eh. And there's quantitative bickering about those, about wind power and solar power. But the bus thing seems pretty simple. Now, how was it paid for? And Grace, hang on, we'll get right to you. We have Grace standing by in Milford. You probably say, well, okay, Paul, how did those fine people in Middle America in Iowa City, Iowa, pay for this whole thing? Well, that's interesting as we scroll down and we find out It's a 2-year pilot program that they extended. It's paid for with a 1% increase in utility taxes, 1%, and they doubled the public parking rates. Ah, so there's the rub, as we like to say. And again, I know the tendency is to say free bus rides, fare, no fare, F-A-R-E, but somebody's got to pay for it. So would you be willing to see a 1% increase in your utility taxes, say if Connecticut tried this, and maybe pay more to park your car when you choose to drive? How about that, huh? Huh? Grace in Milford starts us off today. Hey, Grace, how are you? What's up? You're on the air.
Oh, I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think that this is a wonderful idea, but, you know, they're going to lose a lot of revenue, and our biggest tax that the state gets is gasoline tax.
There you go.
And if people aren't driving, that's going to go down, and we are one of the highest tax states in the nation.
Yeah.
You know, how much more can we take?
It's 25 cents a gallon. You're right, Grace, on each gallon of gasoline. And they're already feeling a reduction in that because of all the electric vehicles. Think about that. There's 60,000 electric vehicles in the state. They're not paying gas tax either.
Right. But yeah. We're also on our electric bill. We're also paying the public tax, whatever that is.
The public benefits
tax. I mean, we just can't take anymore.
Yeah. So, Grace, would you be willing? So, I guess maybe you're not willing to say, or and maybe you are. I don't know. To say, hey, all right, put another dollar on my bill for free bus rides, or you think there's already money for it that they can find?
I would be willing to pay that, but it never ends up
way.
It would end up being a lot more, I'm sure.
Thank you, Grace. Appreciate it. Grace and Milford there. All right, folks. So, look, free bus ride. And I know that's the idiom to say it that way. Hey, the buses are free. Well, wait, no. They're not free. There's no fare. F-A-R-E, not F-A-R-E-R, because life isn't fair. But there's no fare on some of these buses. Iowa City's doing it. Memphis is embarking on an experiment to do it. The incoming mayor in the Big Apple, Zohran Mamdani, he wants to do it. They did it in Kansas City a couple of years ago. In fact, my son was out there working on a show, and he remarked, he goes, hey, the buses are free out here. I said, I know. Good idea for Connecticut. We did this during the pandemic. And I think we spent something like $70 or $75 million worth of pandemic money, you know, COVID-19 money that was spread around like water. And that lasted until, hang on here, I have a story pulled up here just to set the reference point here. And all right, so the fares came back in April of 2023, and they say that ridership dipped there. So look, I this is just me. I'm not saying you have to agree with me, but if you said, hey, Paul, we would, now I live in Wallingford, it's different, it's not Eversource. It's not UI, it's not Avangrid, we have our own grid, you know that. Would I be willing to pay a buck or two a month to subsidize the buses, even though I don't ride them? Yeah, I would, but that's just me. Would you do that? Or should I just shut my mouth about spending your money? Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. You probably may have not heard, I'm betting, about the State Board of Firearms Permit Examiners, a group of people with varying backgrounds, which hears appeals from people who had their permit sought for a revolver or pistol denied. And according to a new state audit, and, you know, this just proves we need to audit as much as we can, as often as we can. There's a backlog of over 1,200 cases here. Now, the common person may say, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, is that backlog so big that these people are being denied their constitutional rights? Whether you think we should have more guns, less guns, or whatever, there's a constitutional question here. And a gentleman I've known for years who is a current state legislator has served on that board in the past. I've watched some of the hearings online. You should watch them. They're fascinating. Wallingford, Middlefield, Republican State Rep. Craig Fishbein. Craig, it's Paul. How are you, man? It's been a while. How you doing?
Hey. Yeah, Paul. Hey, happy holidays to you.
Yeah, man.
On Thanksgiving and all that stuff. And it's nice to speak with you again.
Yeah. Look, I watched some of these hearings that you participated in and local law enforcement and the state police. Fascinating stuff, but Craig, when I was watching these hearings, I would say, geez, I actually wondered, what is the backlog here? And now the auditors say it's such a number that you think, and I'm sure there are people that agree with you, Craig, saying, hey, wait a minute, how is this allowed to drag on? And are these people who are making a legal claim here that they're being denied, how are their constitutional rights being violated here possibly? So talk a little about that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the backlog has been there for years. You know, a lot of it, I think, as being somebody who was internally involved for years, is caused by improper denials by municipalities. For instance, you know, I had a case before the board just this past July. My client had gone through a divorce about 15 years ago. And during the course of that, there was a couple of arrests. The first was a dual arrest where both husband and wife were arrested. And the case went to court and the case was dismissed on both sides.
Yeah.
And then he got arrested about a year later for some verbal dispute. And once again, that was dismissed. And then in 2022, he applied for a pistol permit. He had actually had one before and it was revoked based upon that original arrest.
Yeah.
And the town denied him for that over a decade ago arrests. You know, so we had a hearing before the board, and believe it or not, the town actually showed up, the police officer showed up, and said that my guy was suitable to be issued a permit. So I'm sitting there saying, well, why didn't you issue it? But my client had to wait about 2.5 years for that day. So, yes, I totally agree that in some of these instances, people's constitutional rights are being denied. On the other hand, there are some cases that are legitimately denied.
And sure.
The person uses their ability to appeal and to bring it through our process. And there are certainly some legitimate denials that come before the board. And that's their job. But when improper denials are jamming up the system so that the board is unable to do its due diligence with expedience, that creates a problem.
And so, Craig, what would be the answer here? And again, having watched some of your hearings on CTN, and I urge people to watch them because on several levels they're fascinating here. These things do take time, and you guys and gals who are on the board, you want to be thorough here. We are dealing with firearms, no matter what somebody may think. Should there be two boards? Should there be, as you say, better diligence on the front end of this? Because, again, you know, 1,200, a backlog of 1,200, I mean, that, even for a dummy like me, that sounds like a lot here. What can be done to at least smooth out this system, if anything?
Well, one thing that I am very seriously considering is suing some of the police chiefs that are jamming up the system, that have a record and a pattern of just arbitrarily denying permits, not so much because the person was a bad person, but because they are adverse to regular citizens being able to arm themselves. Additionally, when I was on the board, we would have you know, I was the vice chair and the secretary for most of my terms. And I would have what are known as denial only days, where I would tickle through the file, mm-hmm. because the board deals with not only denials but also revocations.
Got it.
So, you know, that's a whole other aspect of this, where somebody did something or it's implied they did something and their permit was revoked. Those get appealed, too. But I would tickle through the files and, you know, I would take a particular town, review the backup for the appeal, and see on the papers, does it look like there's an abusive process going on here? And then just put 25 files from Waterbury, let's just say, on an agenda for a particular day. If 80% of those are not very good denials, they're going to be very quick hearings. So, you know, that's one way to reduce the backlog. The other way, as you sort of intimated, is to perhaps expand the number of members that are able to hear these cases and to permit through statute panels to be created.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the problem, quite frankly, is funding. The board, they're volunteers. The only thing they get is a meal. you're there all day.
Yeah.
And, you know, the administration through funding essentially controls the amount of hearings. So we literally would have to take our annual budget, figure out how much it would cost us to feed the members, divide that into what we got, and that's how many hearings we could have that year.
So it's about food, what you're saying.
Well, you know.
Got to eat.
It was more than that. But, you know, understanding that when I first got involved with this board, you know, they would start meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to hear those cases, you know. So you put 25 cases on. There were occasions that the board was hearing cases all day long.
Yeah.
Into night, into the next morning. I remember a couple times where the board had been working on cases till like 3 o'clock the next morning.
Wow.
So when I came in, I made a rule about the number of cases that we could hear on a particular day. You know, because if you're there for like 15 hours hearing cases, after a while, your faculty is going to, you know?
Well, yeah, and again, Craig, we're talking about, no matter what people think about it, we're talking about whether somebody should have a firearm. And you're right. You don't want to do something when you're tired or hungry. I get it. No, I understand it. I got it. Yeah. All right, folks, we'll keep an eye on this. Thanks, Craig. Appreciate it. State Rep. Craig Fishbein, currently in the General Assembly, Republican representing Wallingford and Middlefield, who for a long time was on the Board of Firearms Permit Examiners. Craig, good to chat with you again. We'll chat down the road, my friend. Thanks.
Happy Thanksgiving.
All right, thanks, Craig. You too. Tell the wife and the family happy Thanksgiving. Yeah, I'm off tomorrow, so why not have him on today? The man who once a week keeps an eye out for low-flying cavones and stunads. Chris Caruso is here. Chris, how are you, my friend?
And stunads, too, remember?
How many people in our family, Chris, would say, what's the matter with you, stunad? Come on. It's a term of love. Hey, Chris, now we have probably the defined defined candidates for next year. You know, the Governor Ned Lamont, heavy favorite to get his party nomination, almost guaranteed. Yep. But I got to tell you, Chris, I did a little unscientific poll this past week, and with all due respect to both candidates, when I asked my listeners, who tend to be a little more conservative, you know that, I said, hey, if you had to choose top of the ticket, Aaron Stewart or who, you know, has been on the station before, and Ryan Fazio, friend of the station here, a lot of people seem intrigued with Aaron Stewart's profile, her story, and whether she might top the Republican ticket. What do you think?
No, I think that's a good point, Paul. I knew when she got into the race that would be a challenge. There's no question about it. You know, she was mayor of a very large community, New Britain. You know, it's had many issues in New Britain, but from what I could tell and from people I've spoken with, she's been a good mayor. And in turn, I think that presents a challenge for the for Ned Lamont.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean it's going to become a major challenge? We don't know. I think that's yet to be seen. But I think whenever you're in office, and especially governor, the last governor who actually won a third term was Bill O'Neill.
Yeah.
They usually don't win the third term. They don't run for the third term. And so we don't know. I think it's yet to be seen. I think it's, you know, what would Aaron Stewart have to offer? What are her positions? Can she, you know, how should I put it? Can she capitalize on some issues that maybe are vulnerable for Ned Lamont? I think that's all yet to be seen. I also don't think you write off Ned Lamont, because in the same vein, you know, she's going to be, I'm sure, talking about moderation when it comes to financing, the guardrails and so forth. And I think he has a track record that he could speak on. So I think it's yet to be seen. But it definitely spices up the race. I think she becomes, or could become, because we don't know yet, but she could become a very serious challenger. There's no question about it. Don't forget, you also have a primary in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
At least if things stay, if Fazio decides to continue into a primary, and you have Aaron Stewart, yet to be seen. Now, primaries are good in many ways, but they also can beat up candidates as well. Right. So I think it's all yet to be seen. But I don't think the Democratic Party should look at Aaron Stewart as someone that they could just beat, or that she couldn't win. No, I think they've got to take her seriously, absolutely.
Yeah, and also to that extent, you know, part of Ned Lamont's appeal, and you and I have talked about this, Chris, he's a nice guy. He's not. He doesn't throw barbs. He's kind of the guy, hey, let's just get along. This is what I think, but let's work together. So the campaign, I can't see him tossing barbs at either Republican. So that's probably going to come from, I would guess, the legislative leaders, Chris, on that, because I can't see Ned Lamont suddenly flipping a switch and becoming the devil here on the campaign trail. He doesn't do that.
No, and you know, it was interesting. A few months ago, they interviewed Aaron Stewart and Ned Lamont about campaigning. And Aaron said she's not going to make it personal. She's not going to attack the governor. And yet some of her recent videos that she's been putting out on Facebook have been attacks on the governor.
Yeah.
And where she's actually used his name. So, you know, I think that only goes so far, Paul, you know, the attacks. And I think in a society today where politics have become so personal, I would caution any candidate from getting that way.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's going to work. I think you've got to speak on issues. I think you've got to work on issues that affect people directly. And I think in today's society, that's how you win. You know, they talk about the affordability issue, and there's a lot to that.
Yeah.
You know, what are people experiencing? What are they going through? Because that's how people vote. They, you know, everyone says, well, elections are about the future. In some ways they are. But the one thing with elections, you have something every year there's an election. So it has to do more with what people in the moment are experiencing. You saw that with Joe Biden.
Yeah.
You see that to some extent with Trump on certain issues, you know, that he's been vulnerable because he hasn't been addressing those issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really lies in what people are experiencing and the message that you bring across and how you're going to help those people. So I think those are all issues yet to be determined.
Yeah.
But do I think it's going to be an interesting race? Yeah, I do. And I think it's going to be a serious race. And again, I just don't think, you know, the Democrats should take it for granted. Mm-hmm. I don't think in today's world anything is a given.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to work for it. And let's see where it all rolls out.
Yeah. And Chris, in about the minute we have left, I know that sound I heard the other day and the sound you heard here were both you and I screaming at another arrest in connection with the absentee ballot thing. And I had somebody a couple of days ago say, when is this going to end? I said, I don't know. A few seconds left, Chris. What do you think?
I think it's terrible, Paul. And the gentleman who was arrested now, indicted for the fourth time, just doesn't get it. Or maybe he does and just doesn't care. Maybe he thinks he can just flaunt the law. And as we've said before, he's got to be convicted. Frankly, the state's attorney's office has to take this extremely serious.
Yep.
Has to be convicted for his crimes. Right now, he's innocent until proven guilty. Of course, we give that to everyone. But when you get into court, he's got to be convicted. And then there has to be a severe punishment. Because if it isn't, then what we're saying to the public, it's okay to defraud the public. It's okay to cheat on elections. And that Bridgeport means nothing. But I do think, if you notice, there's some plea bargaining going on for those who have committed less offenses. But for the top ones, it was in the paper today, I think Attorney Riccio said that for the top ones, I know the word was top, but I'm paraphrasing, those people with the more serious crimes, it's going to be different for them.
Yeah.
And it should be.
Sure.
Let me tell you, this guy who's now the fourth time, it wasn't just, robbing absentee ballots.
Yeah.
It's falsifying his position.
Oh, yeah, with the badge. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah. So this is like serious. And it's like, it's almost like he's spitting in the eye of law, just saying, I'm going to do what I want. I don't give a damn what you say. I'm going to get away with it. Well, if any time that the law means something and that the law has to, stand for something, it's now.
Absolutely.
And so I just encourage the prosecutors to do what they need to do to bring justice in this case. And for Bridgeport, I was reading, Paul, and quickly, I know you've got to go.
Yeah, we got about 10 seconds, yeah.
Yeah, I was reading a Facebook one day, and someone said, this is Bridgeport. And I wrote back and said, it's not Bridgeport.
Good for you.
These are people who are cheaters, who are liars, that are defrauding the people of Bridgeport. It is not Bridgeport.
Yeah.
And I resent that, because that attitude is, well, it's Bridgeport, so we can get away with
and
it.
That,
no, you can't.
Yeah, and that's the residue of this whole thing. Chris, thank you as always. You have a great weekend, and watch for the low-flying Stunads, okay?
Take care.
All right, Chris, thanks. Chris Caruso, right here on WICC. All right, plenty more controversy still about these mid-ocean strikes on what are allegedly drug-carrying vessels that the White House says are sending chemicals into ostensibly hook and kill Americans. What is the legality of this, and are we getting actionable intelligence on this? Joining us right now to talk about this, CBS News military analyst, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Always great to have him on to pick his brain. Colonel, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and a happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody out there in Connecticut.
Well, thank you, Colonel. We appreciate it. All right, well, let's start with this. The notion, Colonel, that there are different rules of engagement if it's in our territorial waters versus international waters, and we have an idea of intent. Talk about that. I would imagine, but correct me if I'm wrong, that's a gray area here that may pertain or not.
Well, it's a gray area, but again, there's a lot of legality surrounding it. For example, there's a thing called the Geneva Convention of the High Seas, which covers transit through international waters. And of course, transit through American territorial waters is covered by U.S. law and domestic authorization. Now, in that latter case, of course, the president has no authorization that I've heard of from the United States Congress. He calls these particular people combatants. They're conducting war against the United States, but he has not made any effort that I've seen to elicit support from the Congress under the War Powers Act or for an authorization to use military force. So it doesn't seem to apply to that. In terms of on the high seas, the action is that you can't really attack vessels with impunity unless they're pirate ships, which in the case these aren't, or you have the agreement of the country that those particular vessels are flagged with. And beyond that, you have to exercise a certain degree of proportionality. And to what degree do they actually threaten your vessel or threaten your nation or threaten service members, and reply proportionality. And we did that for years, of course, because there are also international legal treaties about how you deal with international smuggling and drugs, but they call for proportionality, and we've done that for years. The United States Coast Guard has been intercepting vessels on the high seas in the Caribbean for many, many years as part of our effort to thwart the illegal immigration of narcotics. And frankly, I've talked to Coast Guard officers who have done that.
Yeah.
And they told me that in 1 out of 5 cases, they discovered that the boat they stopped didn't have any narcotics. So, A, are these people really, you know, conducting war against the United States, or are they simply criminals is the key question. If they're conducting war against the United States, then they're trying to take the nation down like Al-Qaeda was trying to do. That's kind of hard, to accept, because in many ways they're indebted to the fact that the United States has a robust economy. They want to sell something. It's illegal, but they want to sell it, so therefore they don't want to bring the economy down, for goodness sake. And then on the other hand, if they are criminals, then we're back to treating them as criminals, proportionality, arresting them, holding them, but not just inadvertently blowing them out of the water any more than you would authorize a policeman on the street corner in Connecticut that if he knew a guy across the street was a drug dealer, then he had information he was carrying narcotics and he was heading for a grade school, that the officer could pull his revolver and just kill the guy on the spot.
Judging, Colonel, by what you see on the video that the Pentagon and the Secretary of War, Secretary Hegseth, is releasing here, what is actually hitting these boats? Is it air fire? Is it something under the water? Because you're seeing them, I mean, gone in a flash of an eye. What sort of armament are we using here?
Well, it's interesting because there's very little information beyond these videos has been provided. There's been no evidence that, in fact, these particular boats are carrying narcotics. Now, let's be candid. Are they likely, in many cases, carrying narcotics? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
We know that they transit that on a pretty routine basis. But I found it surprising that we haven't seen a presentation of bales of cocaine or other narcotics or weapons or laptops or anything. And furthermore, we have captured a couple of guys who were involved in these, and we immediately released them to their host countries. Interestingly enough, that was Colombia and Ecuador. I don't recall, in terms of conduct of war against Al-Qaeda or conduct against the Taliban, that when we captured somebody that we knew was a Taliban or an Al-Qaeda fighter, that we immediately released him. So by that action, you seem to be undermining the case as well. As far as the particular ordnance, I think it's a variety of ordnance. Could be drones. There's been some talk of use of the so-called C-130J, which we used to call Puff the Magic Dragon, which is a C-130 that's got a Gatling guns that fire out the side of the aircraft and actually have a 105 howitzer they fire out the back. So there's been some suggestion they may be using those as well.
Wow. And finally, Colonel McCausland, what did we hear? And maybe is this a little an indicator, a wink and a nod, that I think it was the U.K., that stopped sharing intelligence with us. So, so does that kind of mean that we, and I think you and I talked about this once, there are probably assets within some of these drug gangs and countries to say, hey, this boat, that boat, or concentrate on this? Because if they say we're stopping, it sounds like there was something there, right?
Yeah, but let's be honest, what we're doing is killing the equivalent of a bunch of Uber drivers. I mean, there's not the head of the cartel that's driving this particular boat. And furthermore, we know that the vast majority of narcotics that really are most inimical to Americans are fentanyl that comes across the border from Mexico or cocaine coming out of Colombia. Very little, in terms of the aggregate, comes out of Venezuela, which is largely a transit country. But it is worrisome that we have had the United Kingdom, which shares intelligence with us under the Five Eyes Agreement and has intelligence assets because of British territory in the Caribbean, have now halted that. The French have also said they thought this was illegal. The Canadian foreign minister in a presentation said he declared this strikes contrary to international law. The head of the Human Rights Commission for the United Nations had said the same thing. And, of course, in addition to that, a lot of these strikes have also been in vessels coming out of Colombia, and the Colombians have suspended all sharing of intelligence that they have done with the United States for many, many years, which was largely about illicit narcotics coming out of South America.
All right. Thanks so much. CBS News military analyst, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, thank you. Always great to have you on. Appreciate the time, sir.
Take care.
Thank you. There you go. There it is. Colonel Jeff McCausland there.